Welcome to Belt Aloda, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today, we're back. It's been a long time. At least I feel like it has. A year? That's about the amount of time. I'm excited for season six. We've watched the first episode. Aaron, I'm super curious to hear what you thought about it.
It has been a long time, although I must admit I've been awash in Expanse. Like we talked about on the preview podcast, like I've nearly completed a rewatch of the series. I reread or read for the first time book five. I'm raring and ready to go. There's a lot of stuff that's kind of a bummer in this episode. Like our heroes are kind of beat down and exhausted. That preening jackass Marco Anaros is just strutting around like he owns the solar system, because he kind of does. Mm-hmm. You can see the cracks forming in his empire already, but you know he doesn't give a shit because he's a preening jackass. And you know, it's kind of like it gets us back into the swing of things by hook or by crook, and they pull out all the stops. There's like what's been going on the last 6 months news montage playing like, an Old Republic serial highlight reel from World War II, you know. More stations fall to Marco Anaros. The Rocinante joins the fight. But I got pumped, you know, by the end of this episode. All I've ever wanted is for Bobby to be a part of the crew of the Rocinante. I saw that with Alex, you know, as the pilot. I feel like that's weirdly unsettled. That's another thing that first impression blew me away. But this episode, like, where the fuck did Bull go? I thought Bull was just going to drop in seamless replacement of Alex. That didn't work out. I was also surprised at how much weight the death of Alex is still kind of weighing down the proceedings. Yeah. But I did get amped because I'm getting a big, sexy, dangerous mission for the Rocinante crew to go on. They're going to be bolstered by our favorite recon Martian Marine, and I'm super happy with where we're going 1/6 into this this season. What do you think?
The one word that I think can describe this season after one episode is weight, or maybe gravity. Everything is, like Christian says in this episode, everything is just weighing down, right? Earth has never been more of a weight on the shoulders of the people who are trying to, you know, save the solar system at this point. And you feel it. You feel it not just in Christian's performance, which is good, but maybe we need to talk about it. And then also, you feel it in the crew of the Rossi. I mean, everybody's still trying to process Alex's death. You feel like Alex died and then they immediately had to go and start this not mercenary mission that they're on, right? Out there just shooting down free Navy ships, shooting down the bad guys, protecting Earth. They didn't have any time to grieve him or process his death. And so it's all those cracks are almost directly a result of that, I feel. Like the loss of a crew member that they were not able to properly figure out how to integrate into their lives.
Yeah, that's what I was. That's one of the questions I want to ask, is like, how much of this is just exhaustion of the mission? How much of this is, you know, them not being able to properly grieve the death of a family member? How much of it is,
it's definitely, you both know,
the friction of a new family member or a new crew member who was controversial to begin with? Like, it's interesting how those, you know, like the Amos Naomi alliance is probably the oldest in the show. Like, it predates the show, like their special relationship, and it's been stressed before, you know, like by Naomi kind of unilaterally doing stuff in season 2 and 3, which was referenced in this episode, but like it's never really fractured, and now it's like it looks like both of them are ready to blow it up. So just the effect that the war has on everybody. The other thing I realized on my recent rewatch of the show is how like sneaky funny The Expanse is. Like The Expanse is really funny. Like if it's like sometimes it's just funny because they're making like, you know, on the surface jokes, you know, Avastral and Amos flirting. Sometimes it's funny just in like the way that Amos is coming to flank Bobby, when she threatens to take back Tatashi with a giant ass fucking wrench, because you know what he's thinking. But like, what I noticed in this episode is it's just, that's gone. Like this, like at least in the early goings of this war arc, is like, there is no more good times. There aren't any chuckles. The only people laughing are two gross teenage boys doing gross teenage boy things. And you find out through the episode, they're not even happy. They're not enjoying what's going on either. Not really. So, and you compare and contrast Drummer's crew at this point to like where they were in the beginning of season five, and how tight knit and how like jokey they were. And, you know, even in kind of tense times, they found the way to have like impromptu microgravity food fights and stuff. There's no room for that. Those people have been replaced with soldiers. Mm-hmm. You know, they become that. They haven't been replaced. They become that instead of the other. And it's painful. It's painful to watch these people not be themselves because of the circumstance.
Yeah. No, I think the days of Lighthearted Expanse are probably gone. I think that was maybe seasons one through four. I mean, as soon as those rocks drop, like everybody's world has changed. Literally,
it's hard to have fun in games. Yeah, it's but I do hope they do find, and maybe they'll find ways with like you know, Amos and Peaches, because they don't seem to be, you know, for various reasons, they don't seem to be as affected as some of the others. Probably because, you know, Clarissa's just still happy to be out of the fucking hole.
Uh-huh. Sure.
And Amos is kind of
a sociopath. Sure.
Yeah, Amos doesn't feel real human emotion all the time necessarily. But yeah, no, but that's the other thing, is like, I feel like, goddamn, watching this season's like an NFL football season. You know, other sports, they fuck around, 180 games. What does it mean to lose two or three? You know, NBA's got like 80, 90 games, and there's 17 games per fucking postseason round. What does it even mean? Well, you know, football, you got 16 games, and every you lose one, and it's tough. Like, I feel like with a 6-episode season, I'm a little bit more angsty, because like, holy shit, 1/6 of it is gone. It's in the books.
Yeah.
And they spend a lot of that time just catching us up to where things, you know, just telling us where things are. And some of the things they told us, I was not super happy about. Like, some of the things that that got yada yadded were like, what?
Dude.
I'm sorry? Rewind? What?
Yeah. So I think it was a good move. They did an effective job of setting up the weight of everything, right? I think read book 6, and maybe we can talk about this. So we're in the final season of The Expanse. As a television show on Amazon
Asterisk.
Prime, right?
Yeah.
At least we think so. And we're in like the final book of a second trilogy and a 3-part set of 3 trilogies that I understand trilogies. Moves a little bit beyond the story that they've told so far in the next book. But I will say.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything that they're doing in the show right now does roughly line up with the books, except for a couple of things here or there, which the show has already riffed on. And they've been doing a pretty good job of that, of riffing a little bit, but coming back to the main source material in enough ways that you feel like you're still watching the same story, just unfolding through different characters, different lenses, all that stuff. And they did that a few times here in this episode. But I definitely feel like they're getting to the crux of what book 6 is for all of these characters, for Marco, for Philip, for, well, I think the biggest changes are probably on the Rocinante, because in the books, Alex is not dead. Alex died, as we all know, as a result of kind of some behind the scenes stuff, with Cass Anvar, that he needed to be removed from the crew. And so they just kind of killed him with a stroke last season. That's changed the game. I feel like that's changed quite a bit on the Rocinante. And I think you still get like most of the way there, but I feel like they're leaning on that kind of as a way to say, hey, these people are not just beaten down physically by the arduous mission that they're on for this extended period of time, but they're also emotionally exhausted because their friend died and they haven't really done anything about that yet. So that's kind of like the biggest change, I think, from the book so far. And there are others around the edges. But you brought up a topic before we were talking, before we got on this podcast here, where we were just talking about like going forward or why this season might be short or something like that. In case we do get more Expanse, which I know you're holding out hope for. I'm not. I'm just thinking, this is the final season and it'll be done. That's it. I'll read the book.
This is interesting because just for podcast aficionados, Jim and I haven't recorded the preview episode. That's something we'll probably talk about in a preview episode. So that was I thought you were on the same page as me that that we will probably some way somehow. There's no way with this much content are starving for. There's no way they're going to leave this on the shelf.
No. I don't know how this
trilogy.
It's clear to me that every season has gotten less attention from Amazon. It's gotten smaller, not bigger. And
really?
I mean, that's my feeling. That's the gut feeling I get looking at the show that they've produced is that every season they've just kind of been ramping down instead of up into something bigger. I really don't think that there are plans, certainly right now, to do more Expanse on Amazon.
Oh, I believe that. I believe that. Or if there is, it's going to be. And I tell you what, we're about to get into the main part of the podcast. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll get into the actual show. And then I want to talk more about this. All right.
Okay.
We'll be back after a quick break. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This week, we're getting our Mad Max on with the prequel Furiosa. Anya Taylor-Joy and Chris Hemsworth team up with director George Miller for some more demented Aussie fun. We'll have a basic spoiler pre-review for everyone, but we're saving the full fuel-injected podcast just for our club members.
Finally, Jim is back from his travels west this week. What thrilling tales we have of the lawless wasteland known as California. Join us live at 1 p.m. or catch the podcast out later in the day.
Time's running out to get your tickets for this year's Badass Fest 6. June 21st at 7 p.m. in the heart of our fair city of Cincinnati. Plus, a side quest opportunity to kayak with Aaron. Get your details and your tickets at baldmove.com/live.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. All right, well, we begin with the Expanse on one of the new alien ring gate worlds. As a little girl is left alone to explore an alien planet, which turns out to be Laconia. You might remember that as being the homeworld of the Martian Splinter Faction group that appeared to be making a protomolecule-powered space cruiser in orbit last season.
Yeah. I wonder what they're going to do with that. I do wonder. It kind of blew my mind last season when I think that was the final shot of the final episode of season 5, where they just go through the rain. You see this big ship come out of like the clouds or something. You're like, oh my God.
So that's
God.
Not something that's even in book six.
No.
Okay. I wondered
not,
if
not
like
that I'm
this.
Aware of.
Okay. Okay. This I definitely want to talk about this expansion of the scope of the Expanse, the expansion of the Expanse. But first, why are they letting this? I get it. This is a militaristic Martian empire. Like Mars is already militarized. This is like the group that split off and decided to name themselves after Spartans and say the other Martians are pussies. Mm-hmm. But still, why do you let like a 9-year-old girl run around an alien planet where like not all of the species has even been like cataloged? Apparently, mm-hmm. There's megafauna walking around. You don't know. Like the whole time I'm like, oh my God, I've seen Half-Life. Those vines are just going to grab that girl and suck her up.
Yeah.
Or like, holy shit, those bird things are going to be venomous. That fucking purple frog, that's just a head. You're going to see it's as big as a house, and it's got a mouth that's like it'd swallow a blue whale. who watches the babies on this planet, man? Is this some kind of fucked up way of making sure you just get real Martians?
Yeah, this is Darwin, survival of the fittest. Yeah, this is some attrition shit. I don't know.
This is like King Leonidas's origin story. Uh-huh. I walked with the purple frogs and the poisonous lizard bats of Laconia, and I emerged victorious. Like, it's some fucked up shit, man.
I was thinking the same. I'm like, this girl unsupervised. I kept expecting this thing to jump out of the forest and just consume her. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, one big bite just right over the top, and she's gone.
It's very Jurassic Park. This girl is playing in a clearing. She's going to scream, and then, you know, Laura Dern's going to bound in and mm-hmm. do something.
Sam Jackson's arm will drop on her shoulder. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Something like that. Let me jump back and talk about the title of this episode, Strange Dogs. I actually don't even think I said that in the intro. This is the title of the novella that's between, is it Persepolis Rising? I think it's Persepolis Rising, which is book seven and Babylon's Ashes, which is book six. This is like novella 6.5. Kind of focuses on, I think this girl, Kara is her name, or Kara, and her family kind of being through the ring gate on Laconia, trying to make a new life on that planet. I haven't read that novella because I didn't think it was very essential. And I haven't, I read their book six. I haven't moved beyond book six though. So, I don't know what they're getting up to here, but I will say, yeah, it was weird, a weird start to this, but it does tease like, hey, we're going to do some through the gate Laconia stuff. Right. Cause otherwise why put this at the beginning?
Right. My thought is it's a sales pitch for book 7 through 9, because here. So here's what I'm, you know, and this is spoiler free because I've not read anything beyond book 6, and I haven't read any short stories beyond that either. And I've been very careful to stay spoiler free, but I have seen some people discuss in a spoiler free context, like a meta of like, you know, why is things coming to an end here at book 6? And you think about trilogy and trilogy of trilogies, right? The first trilogy was all confined to our solar system, which felt like a big place, right? But then in the book three, the ring gates all opened, and now we see that there's you know over 1,000 more worlds to explore. What are we going to do? I've heard that going from book 6 to book 7 is a similar expansion in scope. And I don't know what that means, because like, I don't, does that mean like multiverse, or does that mean like some kind of harnessing or mastery of the protomolecule, which will, and with the exotic alien life that we see in display of here, that you're essentially bootstrapping a Star Wars trilogy, you know, and like that the money that you would have to spend on the show because of the increase of special effects, because maybe aliens, because of maybe like intense starship battles, because of the crazy protomolecule science fiction magic shit, that the budget is just going to spiral, and you essentially need like to completely renegotiate everything. And if this is like the gateway between book 6 and book 7, if this is like a portent of things to come, that makes a lot of fucking sense, because this looks like a much more expensive show than what we're getting right now, which has essentially submarine sets and some splashy FX shots for sure, but it's not in every fucking scene. You don't have like a purple dinosaur.
Yeah, and those splashy FX shots are drones and hard edge ships and knowing even the tiniest bit about 3D, I know it takes longer to create organic creatures, things like that.
100%.
Basically anything you can make out of primitives is probably not going to take you much time.
And animating it. Yeah. All that.
Right. So the ships are not a problem, but then you get to, creatures and stuff that would be hard. So, as somebody who doesn't think they're going to do more of the Expanse, there's no way they get to that stuff. There's absolutely no way they expand the scope of the Expanse in season 6 with only 6 episodes and now 5 episodes to go. They just can't. They can't. Knowing the story of book 6 and the things that they have to deal with, the things that are already on their plate, you can't load up anymore. You can't.
So that's what I'm saying. I expect this plus like some kind of post credit scene, because we already know the final episode is like a monster. It's like 65, 70 minutes long. Okay. I think that there's going to be a big pitch. They're going to leave Expanse fans desperate for more, and then the new Screaming Firehawks campaign is essentially, hey, shouldn't you we get out there being loud and proud about like HBO picking this up for a miniseries option, or Warner Brothers picking this up for a 3-picture deal. Or like it's going to be something like that, because I think they just need. It's my theory that this is all about, getting a budget big enough to tell this big fucking pan-galactic story that they're trying to tell, and it just isn't enough on the budget to got them this far. Because that's the only thing that makes sense to me. Why else would you tease this shit that's going to be beyond this season, or as you say, not relevant? The only nightmare scenario I can think of is they're bringing just enough of like books 7 through 9 to make it not worth telling. That's one of the reasons I didn't personally like, what was the Joss, was it Serenity? What was the Firefly movie?
Serenity.
It was Serenity. I didn't like that movie, not because I didn't think it was good necessarily, but it just finished Firefly.
Yeah, it was
like
everything.
You would have to, like, every open question you had, significant parts of the crew taken off the board. Like, that was the nail in the Firefly coffin. Yeah. There was always hope to have more. You could always bring, they're not too old. Everyone seemed like they were into it. But, like, when that movie came out, that was just, my mind waving the white flag. And I guess the only thing they could do to kind of piss me off this season is if they bring in enough of like 7 and 8 and 9 to just like essentially just put a cap on those storylines without exploring them, because I don't want that. Yeah. I like having 3 more books of the Expanse to enjoy as a standalone thing and maybe one day to be adapted. I would much rather have that than a half-ass dash through them. And I don't know, but there's no way with 6 episodes they're going to do that, I don't think.
Yeah, I wouldn't think you could. That scene at the beginning is super worrying. The scene we're still talking about with Kara, because I just think this series is going to be somewhat radioactive after
the
end of it. I mean, Sci-Fi dropped it. Amazon's going to drop it. Who picks up this potato and says, yeah, we can do something with that? Like,
well, the thing is, that's the thing. Like, Sci-Fi dropped it, but for, I guess, reasons that made sense. It wasn't making money.
exactly.
I don't know that Amazon's dropping it, though. Or,
I mean, they're not letting them do the rest of the story. There's no way they get through the rest of the story here. Yeah. I mean, Amazon,
and if they wanted twice the budget,
dropping it,
like, surely they would go and say, hey, we need twice the budget. And then Amazon would be like, sure, yeah, or no. So those conversations have had to happen. But then I guess if you don't want to make more, why the intro?
Yes.
Why? Because to me, that is only that. And that's only a trailer for more Expanse. Kind of like if all we got at the end of, I think that if Expanse stopped in season 3, it would still be, work because it's kind of self-contained. Like, yes, there's clearly more expanse, like, oh my god, there's Ringgate stuff, but like all of the you know, Mars Earth war protomolecule plot, all that stuff was neatly tied up and ended. Which I appreciated, but you still had, like, you know, Naked Holden screaming in space beholding the the Ringgate system. I wonder if this is that version of, like, Naked Holden screaming in space. Like, if it ends in the sixth season and that's all we get, then there's still a hint that, like, hey, there's a, I mean, it could be Ty and Dan, like, fuck, let's just advertise the next books. Like, there's more expanse, you just have to read our books, fuckers. And in the meantime, the more that's successful, I just, like, here's my bedrock thing. We have so many places that are desperate for content. They're adapting crazy shit, stuff that's always been considered unfilmable. Foundation, Wheel of Time, The Silmarillion, shit like that. Like, they are really priming all the fantasy science fiction pumps for more content. They're going to walk away from a completed book series that has a fan following just because it's, like, hard to film or expensive. Like, I just don't see... all the studios out there, all the channels, all the stuff, all of them say no. That seems hard to believe. Very hard to believe.
Now we'll see. Maybe it'll get a 2-season run on Netflix and they'll cancel it for its third. That'd be great.
I mean, clearly that's what I don't want, like, half a series and then it gets canceled on Paramount Plus or something like that. I want someone like, you know,
HBO.
Netflix.
HBO would treat,
I want
this
something
thing
like
right.
But HBO's in the middle of their own kind of, like, you know, tumult of, like, well, what are we doing here? How much content are we wanting to make? Are we making Christmas movies? I guess we are. But yes, that's the ideal home for The Expanse.
Yeah.
If Amazon doesn't want it.
The HBO of yesteryear, the one before HBO Max, that puts money into shows simply because they're prestige and simply because it will heighten their reputation. Not necessarily because it will make them a ton of money.
So to go back to this trailer for season 7, is there anything that this little, so the little girl sees the bird lizards and one of them looks like it drops dead and she grabs it and picks it up and runs off saying she's going to save it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any interest in, like, trying to figure out what they're doing here?
No,
or like they tell, like, my first thought was War of the Worlds. This little girl has infected them with some kind of microorganism and it's dropping dead.
I feel like we've already done that. I feel like season 4 was some of that. I don't know if we need to
revisit. Reverse War of the Worlds. We were the invaders with the eye fungus getting brought down low.
Right. We're still the invaders. We're on foreign worlds that, you know, they had this planet before we did. I don't know. We'll see. I have no idea where this is going. I don't even know why it's in here, really. But we'll find out, I assume.
Let's move on to the credit sequence. I like to talk about this at the beginning of every season because it usually changes, and it's changed a lot. We had questions about how fucked the Earth is. I think those questions are answered by the credit sequence, if not the other stuff. The Earth is continuing to be pelted. Lots of images of the Ringgate now and alien worlds. In fact, the iconic shot of Holden gawking up at something in space in a spacesuit has now been replaced of him gawking at the Ringgate. Anything else you there, did you just fast forward through the intro?
I always do, man. I always well, I didn't fast forward, but I used it to make some notes on the Laconia stuff. So
this show is always good, and like immediately, like in my rewatch, I noticed that, like, the Mars thing when UN destroyed Phobos. I think it was Phobos or maybe it was Deimos. The moon of Mars that they destroyed in season one.
Retaliation, yeah.
As soon as they do, when they show the diagram of Mars, that moon is broken apart and animated.
Nice.
And it's like, they always do shit like that. And I always like to see what's changed.
Yeah, it's like the Game of Thrones intro, right?
Yeah, a little bit, similar dynamicism. Yeah.
I should pay attention, but I don't.
We're open. We open to an off-season montage. This is what's happened in the last 6 months or so.
Yeah.
Anything that caught your eye in this rapid-fire newsreel?
The number one thing that caught my brain is they must have listened to the audience, who was very confused in season 5 about how devastated the Earth was. Sometimes you see a little bit of the forest got knocked down. No big deal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of all we saw of it, right? And then we were just like, oh, business as usual. This paints a totally different picture. This paints devastation. This paints this is something that the Earth may never recover from. It might be a death spiral from which they can't escape.
Yeah. There's this big bold letter, severe biosphere damage. And this has also had the effect of letting Marcos just run rings around the solar system because he has been... They showed a schematic of all the different stations. They mentioned Ceres, Vesta. Mm-hmm. Those are the two largest asteroids in the asteroid field. Prospero, Ganymede, Epidus. Third largest moon of Saturn. All these things have been taken over. The ones that resisted, like Pallas Station, which is the third largest asteroid in the solar system, has been attacked, and their station's disintegrating.
Wow, Pallas? Really? Shit, didn't Marco launch from Pallas last season? Wasn't that his, like, home base?
I think that's how, like, him and that was Naomi's kind of, like, their home crew kind of thing.
Those are the other major shipyards, right? Like, you got Tycho Station, you got Pallas, which is one of the
I'm not exactly sure that its importance in the belt. Because I'm still, like, I still am deathly afraid to look at the Expanse Wikipedia.
Fair. Yeah.
But, anyway, they also have a show. They also have a shot of like New York City, and it looks like the skyscraper Venice because the seawalls have been breached and the city's flooded. And they also have like I really appreciated this touch of detail. We began the Expanse back in season one with this Belter provocateur screaming into a camera on Sirius Station about how the Inners are abusing the Belter's going to rise up, and the same guy is now talking about how Earth knows what it feels like to be a Belter. And I like that. Yeah. It's the same guy from series, probably still doing his fucking OPA podcast or whatever it is. And now he's delighted that it's the capital of the belt.
I think Golden Bough has a podcast.
Yeah. I think they all do. Like every one of these. Black Sun. They should. Yeah. I want to hear the Klaus Ashford one, because you know he seemed to like having ears and microphones. Oh, yeah, Belter Lotus, eyes and ears. It's how we begin every one of our podcasts.
He's doing pirate radio.
He is. We also have a really cool shot after that. We have the blackness of space, asteroids hurtling towards Earth, but they're melt by purple clouds. They're met with purple clouds and railgun shots that shatter them on impact, and then Avasarala surveys the damage done to Mother Earth and gets status reports.
Yeah, we've got that nuclear-esque winter that I talked about somewhere else in another podcast. I can't even remember. But yeah, things are looking real bad on Earth, and they're pinned down too. I think that's like the biggest thing to take away from this. Well, the second biggest probably is that they can't really do anything with their fleets. They can't go after Marco because they're using their fleet to defend from hundreds of rocks that have dropped on them over the last 6 months.
200 strikes in 6 months.
Yeah.
So it's a constant. And we'll find out more about how Marco is even being even more strategic about keeping the Inners. But like Mars and Earth have completely redeployed their fleets to defend their planets. You know, they're vulnerable at the bottom of these gravity wells. Mm-hmm. Also, it's like there's another sad story is they Mars is remilitarizing, building a Doniger class warship. Earth is building 3 battle cruisers. You think about the resources they probably need at a time like this, and unfortunately, they have to be diverted into. And it's hard to argue. Like, you can't just let rocks keep hitting you. And it's like it's just a real depressing scene because she says there's also micrometeor contamination. Like even the rocks that miss us and burn up in our atmosphere are poisoning us. Mm-hmm.
And the scrubbers, the CO2 sucks. Scrubbers that they're using to kind of get that out of the air aren't really working.
Well, I thought that was more of like they got CO2 scrubbers to deal with global warming, but they've reversed them. Like they're now re-scrubbing the air with CO2 to hopefully warm it up but that's having. Okay. You know, some unexpected effect. It's I don't know. It's a bad scene, and she talks about this, like, she's overlooking this huge high-yield grain growing facility, and she talked about when it first opened this, you know, we're from the Midwest, we know what stocks are. Even the fattest stalks of corn, they're not bending over at the end of harvest, but these things are probably genetically modified. Ears of corn the size of watermelons.
These are ears of corn that could win a county fair, for sure.
This is super corn, baby. And it's all like, who knows? This whole area might feed a billion people, and it's gone. It's just nuts, but ash and snow.
Yeah.
And it just like they have a lot of shots where they just like show the emotional state. Like Avasarala is just consumed with largely impotent rage and grief, you know. And it's what I love about Avasarala's character is that she's such a great avatar for like Earth itself, because she feels the losses like professionally in terms of like, you know, she thinks of herself as Earth. She's being attacked, but she also has very personal losses. Like, you know, the fucking Where's fraudulent Arjun. Yeah. He's been missing for several seasons, but ostensibly killed. The imposter killed last episode or last season. And then this goes back to also like, you know, in previous wars, those losses are personified in her son. Yeah. She's a great like figure for, I think, all of Earth.
I gotta say, they need to get like the CO2 scrubbers working on like Shore's, working in her dressing room or something, the green room, wherever she's waiting. Because is it just me, or am I freshly shocked every fucking season when I hear her speak at her voice? Her voice is just so wild, man. It feels like it's getting gravelier. Like it is.
It's like, It's crazy because like also not having with the screeners, not having subtitles. Like I had to rewind an embarrassing amount of times before I understood that what she was saying is meteorite contamination, because it sounded something like meteorite contamination.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
wild,
what?
Man.
Yeah,
it's great. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like making fun of her, but holy shit. I'm just shocked at her voice every time I come back for a new season.
Yeah, they could do some carbon scrubbing of the lungs. Maybe. I don't know, or maybe that's just she's got the genetic husk. Uh-huh. She's never smoked a day in her life. I don't believe that, but moving on to the Rocinante crew, showing exhausted from months of constant patrolling the belt, but nevertheless valiant in uncovering a new wrinkle in Marco's effort to keep Earth and Mars pinned down in their respective gravity wells.
Yes. They're out there fighting Free Navy ships, but they're not mercenaries. They're not getting. So are they getting paid for it at all, or are they just getting resupplies?
That's the thing. It's like you know, Amos floats the idea of getting Chrissy to pay for all the every ship they shoot down, and Holden's bristles. Like, we're not mercenaries. Like, we're sure shit ain't soldiers either. So in the last book, they were wealthy. You know, heroes of Illus, they were directly employed by the UN. They wanted for nothing. I wonder if they don't spell it out, but I wonder if they're actually waging this private war out of their pocketbooks, their own pocketbooks.
Could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll be a problem. I think this is just a fun thing for Amos to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if we are ready to talk about this part, but when he goes out to repair the hull, I loved some of the effects work that they were doing.
It's like playing Mario Galaxy, right?
Yeah, with these what I assume are like deranium hull plates.
That's what I thought too, yeah. He's going to slap on the patch.
They probably weigh a lot. They probably weigh a lot, and he's just like dragging them around with one hand in zero G. It's a really cool effect.
Yeah, I love the fixed frame of him, and he's just kind of like, it reminded me of playing Mario Galaxy, that like, you know, the Earth is spinning, or the Earth, the Rocinante is spinning cool underneath him. And then like just this cool stuff, like as he gets and starts walking back towards, you know, the trench or wherever he's going, the where the rail gun's mounted, the drone pot, you know, the little door that has a drone opens and pops out, and it is neat. That. There's a lot of a lot of cool space porn, like just a taste of a battle, you know, not much, but just a little bit of, you know, I love seeing the PDCs shoot. I love seeing the Martian torpedoes cook off.
I did feel like they started this with a bang. And next scene, literally, Yeah. And this scene, literally. I mean, they shoot this thing down. I felt like we were out of the gates moving pretty fast, and it didn't really slow down this entire episode.
No, no. They have they're having to explain and say a lot, but they're doing it in some big sexy ways.
Yeah.
They also like so what draws their attention is that they wondered because these little skiffs far too small to be able to push a rock mm-hmm. to do something with. And they see a drive cone directly affixed to the asteroid.
Yeah.
Self-propelled asteroid rockets, a new wrinkle in Marco's war. I thought that was kind of cool, too.
Yeah. Why don't they have stealth tech on these? Are they just not getting the funding they need and the gear that they need to stealth these rocks?
So I think this and that's one of the things I like about the Expanse is they allow you to surmise this stuff. The mm-hmm. only reason that the OPA had Martian stealth tech last season is because Mars was playing fast and loose in the, you know, depopulation and trying to like stay afloat. They just had a flood mm-hmm. of military shit on the market and was going to the highest bidder. Once the rocks started dropping on Earth, I bet Mars got real tight with that shit again. And now you're seeing they mentioned that there hadn't been a stealth rock for months. So I think they just ran out of that material and they can't manufacture their own.
And you don't have was it Duarte? Was that the guy's name who was on the inside? Feeding them information about where to get it, right? Or how to, when the shipments are coming, where they'll be, all that stuff. So
it seemed like that alliance ended the moment that they took the ring gate. Like there is no longer any direct, like I think that Marco's got every Martian ship he's ever going to have now. He's got every tech. He's it's like, it's going to be mm-hmm. a war of attrition now, which he's not even feeling because the inners are pinned down. In the inner planets.
Yeah, no, so. I'm curious to see if that's the case or so is he going to have another army at his back? Is he going to have the proto-molecule based army at his back?
That's a good question.
And fight a two-front war here?
I've got some speculation on what Laconia is doing. You know, that might indeed be their plan. Like they'll have a beachhead that they can hold from all attackers, and they can come back and reclaim the solar system if they want with advanced proto-molecule tech. I've got theories about what they're heading towards there, but
gotcha.
I don't think they'll get to it in this season. Doesn't feel like it.
Yeah.
Anyway, what do you think about how Peaches is integrated with the crew? Do you think that Amos's mother hinting her a little bit, or that was just kind of some banter to establish their working, the fact that Clarissa is a good tech now. She had promised before, but if she wasn't focusing stuff on murderous rage, she's become a quite competent mechanic.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of she's still newish to the crew, and this is a guy who's very protective of the ship. Amos, I think he does trust her. I think he also just really wants the Rossi to be worked on in a certain way and knows her super well, better than anybody else. So he's not my mother handing her, but he is definitely careful about the way he wants her to treat the Rossi.
So you mentioned that you thought that they were pulling money out of this show. I think that I think we're seeing the Rossi's engine room for the first time. Like, I felt like that they built a new set that where Clarissa goes in and she's strapping these toolkits down. And there's like, I think that's like the Rossi's reactor. And I'm not saying you're wrong that they're like trying to, cut down like, staffing and budget and stuff like that. But they don't need, I wonder why they build this set. Is it something they needed, or maybe I'm mistaken? Maybe they built it and I didn't notice it before. But
no, it might be new. I'm not sure.
I can't remember them ever going in there. The other question I have is why isn't Bull here? Were they unable to come to a cop? Like, did that guy pull like a Godfather? You know how they had who was the capo that wanted a ton of money? It wasn't Tessio, it was the other guy. He wanted a ton of money to come back and like, fuck you, we'll just recast you. This guy's like, Cassandra's out of thing. You need a new pilot, huh? Well, and they're like, nah, fuck you. We'll just have Naomi drive. Like,
the only thing I can think is with Fred dead, Tycho is going to be, like, with that whole coup attempt, Tycho's going to be sort of undermanned, yeah, and they need Fred's Tycho dead. To be pumping out.
Drummer is gone.
Ships, because they're still loyal to the Earth, right? To the UN.
You think Bull's the Tycho administrator now?
That's my guess. Is yeah, he was needed. And if he's not the administrator, he was at least needed back there more than he was needed on the Rossi on some mercenary mission.
I'm just shocked that, like, especially since Alex is alive in the book, I thought they were just going to seamlessly replace him. There's going to drop Bull in there. And, you know, he has a simple, you know, he's got
too.
A one season of experience with the crew. He's clearly a good pilot for the Rossi, and they would just have him do Alex things.
Yeah.
Seems like I don't know, like,
Bobby step into that role, if I had to guess.
Maybe because Bobby said, like, when she was, you know, on the run with Avasaral and the Razorback, like, she's a fair pilot, but she's a Marine. Like,
she's probably
a
better pilot than any of the other three. Left,
possibly.
Or four,
possibly.
I guess, with Claire.
But Alex was... I think they is something special, you know.
Oh yeah, for sure. The Rossi definitely lost something with the death of Alex, but I think Bobby will suffice. And we certainly like Bobby a lot more than Bull. I don't know how you felt, but I did.
I wasn't especially. I just thought that Bull would be kind of like a drop in, unoffensive replacement. And I'm surprised they're going this route. That said, I also am kind of glad that they're not. I thought they might just gloss over the death of Alex. Like, you know, hey, we had the whole, you know, we did it last season. We had the everybody, we had the plaque, we had everybody looking somber, and it'll just be, we'll just move on from there. But I think it's appropriate, especially since clearly this book must be a somber book too, to deal with a little bit of an extra dimension, a personal dimension of grief. So.
And they have the plaque in this scene, right? Before
Amos stares at it. Yeah.
Alex's name still on it and Claire's name not on it, which I think is equally important to Amos.
That's a good
point. And
that's
just demonstrating, you know, it's a physical representation of the emotional cracks that are forming in this group.
Yeah. Yeah. Over on Ceres, the newly self-proclaimed capital of the belt, Philip relieves some stress while his father Marco meets with his advisors on the state of the war effort. What'd you think of these scenes?
Oh, man. There's so much good stuff in here. Stuff that I'm personally excited, having read the book, that they're going to hopefully get into. Although 6 episodes is not a long time to do it. And the book doesn't go super deep into it. But I'm interested in a lot of the stuff that they're setting up with the... rationing of resources and how that's going to play out, the dynamics between the different factions of belters, some of the belters who are just barely aboard with the cause, and might be, you know, influenced by Earth if they were able to provide for them better. It raises so many interesting possibilities once we get beyond the initial strike. To now, like Marco, they're very much painting a picture of a man who enjoys the destructive aspect of what he's doing, the disruptive part of it. But what he doesn't care about is rebuilding anything. And that to me is exciting.
There's no glory in it. There's no glory in it. There's no people cheering his name.
He can't be a hero simply by allocating resources appropriately. Yeah.
Looking at spreadsheets. But that is like what a lot of statesmanship is about, taking care of your people.
And that's the beautiful juxtaposition between him and Avasarala, who is worried about, is doing that stuff, right? She's lamenting the loss of the grain. Marco's casting that, you know, beneath him task off on his underlings. Like,
I like, because we talked about this last season, the fact that there seemed to be, you know, some political bias to the science of Marco. Like, you know, that there's people saying, you know, you can't just destroy the only active biosphere the solar system has and think you're going to be able to feed people. Like, where are we going to get live soil? Where are we going to get this? And he's just like, details, details. And it reminded me of like some of the head up their ass things that Soviet Union did in the 30s and 40s that led to massive starvations because they saw certain science as Western influenced. And it seems like they are definitely going to double down on that, because there is some scary shit if you're paying attention. You know, like Marcos, the series administrator, the governor of the capital, is saying it's not a matter of when or if, it's a matter of when people here and in the capital city are going to start starving.
Yeah. It's Nico.
Nico, okay. Who is, okay, so who is the statuesque blonde lieutenant of Marco and Arrows? Because I've never, and I didn't catch her name. Do you know who that is?
I don't know that they ever say, they do say her name. They say her name one time in this. It's Rosenfeld Guilliang, which is a character in the sixth book. But
she is, she made is a huge impression. Okay. She made it, she made a huge impression. Like, I was like, this is...
Yeah.
Not a great impression, because she seems to sure. be like, if you want Marcos to have a second, you kind of want them to fill in the gaps that the leader has. And it seems like she's got all the same kind of crazy emphasis on action, inattention to details, you know, that they do. And this is great stuff, because they also show, like, this is classic, you know, despot shit. You know, like the preening, the giving these speeches, like as soon as he hears his name mentioned, he's got to stand up on a crate and grandstand, and just having no interest at all in the day to day details of running the empire. Yeah. It's infuriating, to tell you the truth.
You know what else is infuriating?
What's that?
Let's talk about maybe the worst thing that the show The Expanse has ever done. And it's
I know what you're gonna say,
the mistreatment of Anderson Dawes, because Anderson Dawes is alive in book six, and in fact I think Anderson Dawes, you know, survives the whole series. I don't know, I don't know if he's old enough when the time jump happens that he's dead later on, but he doesn't, Margo doesn't kill him in the books, and if he was gonna kill him on the show, he certainly shouldn't have killed him off screen. I think Anderson Dawes has been misused and mistreated since season three, when he disappeared, and
season
has just
three
become
is where, like,
the boogeyman appearing in video footage once every other season.
And I'm fairly certain, now that I've seen this again in rapid, like a recent binge, that those scenes of, you know, Fred Johnson talking to him on his phone were just old scenes from him in season one and two that they desaturated and made it look like a cell phone, you know?
Sure. Redub it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They have not got fresh Dawes since season two.
I'm so angry about this, because Jared Harris is such a good actor, and all you need to make this work in season six is one scene. And what a scene it would be, with Anderson Dawes, Jared Harris sitting across from Marco, and these two, you know, this egomaniac battling with this also, you know, fairly egotistic, but a little more rational guy on...
It's taken years to solidify his power, who has carefully built alliances and played both sides, and...
He's so good at his craft, and then you've got a guy who has become the hero of the belt just through sheer bravado and taking chances and not giving a shit about any of that other stuff. Have them sit down, have them disagree, have Marco put a bullet in his head. That's all you need. One scene, 3 hours of Jared Harris's time. Fuck, he can do it from home on a green screen. Get
that's
him
the thing.
In
I don't-
there.
I don't know who to be mad at, because Jerry Harry has had quite the career since season one and two of The Expanse. He headlined The Terror. He headlined HBO's Chernobyl. He's headlined a little show, the Foundation, that we just got done covering. I'm pretty sure he's the reason that he hasn't been on more Expanse. But
I
also,
I
like,
the
why
the
slipping. Fuck can't you give him a Godfather offer? Because that that scene sounds amazing. Because number one, it's ironically delicious, because he is now being Fred Johnson. You know, sure. Fred Johnson was the state, like, you know, just trying to, like, do what's right. You know, trying to, like, play the middle, trying to be a statesman. And Anderson Dawes always outflanked him on the rebel side, on the belter, from the belter side.
Yeah.
And now someone beltier than thou is going to outflank him and make him look radical. Like, oh, come on, Pampa, tell us again about how we got to feed the people and the spreadsheets and all that. And with in light of this episode, it had been a really great contrast to Philip, where, like, when Philip gets frustrated about an unpleasant truth that he doesn't want to deal with, he kills it, you know. And his father does the same thing, where it would strengthen that connection, because they've done a lot of, I think they've done a better job, honestly, connecting thematically and emotionally Philip to his mother than they have to his father.
Yeah.
And that would have been a really great tie.
Uh-huh. No, no, it would have been a fantastic scene. And that's all I would have needed. But I don't know. Clearly, like, they have somebody else running Ceres Station. Why would he be around? I don't know. There are a lot of questions, but...
It would have been a good scene. And it's too bad we didn't. It's too bad we didn't get more Jared Harris. And I'm not sure who to be mad at.
Oh, I feel like it is. That's one of the main reasons I say this show has not been doing as much, because I think you could have got him back. You just didn't want to pay to get Jared Harris in there.
Yeah,
and you just kind of waved it away.
He made me just. I just want to do one show a year. I like to torture my fan base. I don't like them to be too. I don't want them to be fed. I want them to be hungry. But yeah, the other thing about the scene is that we see that Marco is the most thing he's interested in, other than feeding, and certainly not feeding his people, is where is the people who have defied him? Where is Drummer? Where is Naomi? And James Holden, the Rocinante, and he ups both of their bounties by 20%, again, as his people are starving.
Yeah.
Speaking of Drummer, her faction / family is out in amongst the battle wreckage of the belt in a pretty cool scene. Oh. They evade bounty hunters.
Are we not going to talk about Philip's friend catching up with him and the alligator vest stuff?
Yeah, sure.
And
talk about
part
that, Jim.
Of that scene? Oh,
this
shit.
Was. Yes, that was part of the scene. That
I mean,
part of the
kind
scene.
Of.
Right.
Okay. So I
Phil's got a punk ass friend.
Yeah,
he wears alligator.
In the book, Philip gets the jacket. Philip gets the jacket. Is he going to take it off the dead body of his friend? I don't know.
Feels like that's, or I don't know, maybe they're making a joke about how outlandish his character was in the book. Like he's got an alligator jacket or alligator skin vest or something. I don't know.
No, it was wild to me. But yeah, I would think if this is real alligator skin, it's probably pretty valuable.
Oh, yeah.
Then they make a point, there might not be any more of this shit like coming off Earth ever.
Alligator, they're not making any more. Although I wouldn't bet against alligators. Alligators are like 400 million year old killing machines. They've dodged an asteroid or two canonically. Let's not count them out just yet, young Belter.
They might take over the Earth.
Yeah, but this guy is introduced just as a way, just as a way to show how far gone Philip is since his mother left.
Yeah.
But anyway, we catch up with Drummer again. Her faction family is out floating in the belt, evading bounty hunters amongst the wreckage of the many battles that have been taking place. They're able to evade and take out the bounty hunter, however, at the cost of one of their own ships. Largely as a result of the hesitation and ineptness of one of their family members.
Oh, is that a result of that? I thought the plan was to use the DeWalt as a improvised explosive device.
It looked like they had a makeshift railgun welded to the thing, and the idea was they were going, and she said it's a direct line of fire, so they're going to use the thrusters to track it and then shoot it. I mean, that was the last resort, but clearly they weren't done. Maybe there was something wrong with the ship because they were in the process of evacuating it, but they didn't do a complete evacuation. So.
Yeah, I think the plan was to shoot the ship to blow it up with like a railgun round instead of using a torpedo, which is way more valuable. Mm-hmm. That was my thought on it, because then they make a big deal about how we salvaged one missile from the DeWalt and now we have a grand total of three because they had to use at least one, maybe more.
They definitely used the DeWalt to blow up. They released a magnetic containment, but I don't think that was the plan.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I think that might have been the backup plan, or maybe there was something wrong with the DeWalt that they couldn't recover, but they didn't want to abandon all the shit that was on the DeWalt for sure.
It's kind of a big deal because the DeWalt is Drummer's ship, right? Like that was sort of the flagship of her little family fleet. That seems like a big loss to them.
I mean, yeah, like the fact that they only had three and now they have presumably two, or maybe they're down to one now. I'm not quite clear on that, but yeah, it's a huge loss in being in the middle of the war with three torpedoes.
Yeah, and now they have to go try and find somewhere to resupply, which it seems like they're having trouble finding ports to dock in. You know, they're kind of in a weird no man's land where they're not loyal to Marco, and he controls most of the belt, but they're not pledging for the inners either. And so really no one will accept their docking request, which is a tough place to be when you have three torpedoes and your mission is to try to take supplies from other ships to feed the belters, I think was their mission.
Or just resist Marco. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing, because they're just probably, you know, and that's this is where this newsreel comes into play, because they show a good job of how Marco has just really got so much of the belt that, like,
yeah,
maybe not all of them swear allegiance to him, but the mm-hmm. idea you could get in and out of a place without some spy hearing you is getting tougher and tougher.
Was it the Golden Bough that weren't pledging allegiance to Marco?
I have no idea. And there's something in the walk and talk after with 6 months.
Yeah, with
there again, Rosenfeld. Yes. I wish I had subtitles, because she said a couple of factions, but the important thing was they weren't Drummer and they weren't the Rocinante.
So, right.
Let's take a quick break and then we'll get back to the episode. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. All right, we're back with Holden jumping down to the rock to take a look-see, exploring the engine installation on the asteroid that they're investigating. You're never going to guess this, Jim, but something goes wrong.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Holden pushes a button and something goes wrong.
Does he push a button?
He plugs something in. It's a kissing cousin of button pushing. He's plugging in terminals into other terminals.
This felt like a fail safe in case of tampering, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly.
It was just he opened it up and so it went into activation mode. This is, I guess, terrifying for Naomi, because they've already lost Alex, and here's Holden doing something stupid and reckless and trying to save the fucking world again. So Holden, and putting himself in harm's way to do it. And man,
While she's sitting in Alex's chair. So, like, she's sitting right, in, like, she can feel the ghost of him.
Like, first time I flew the Rossi, it felt like, it's wild, man. Holden, I get it. He's altruistic, right? He wants to save everyone, but boy, the hell he puts his loved ones through in the meantime in service of that goal is brutal.
Yep. That's what it's, that they deal with that a lot in For All Mankind, you know, like the cost, it's easy being the charging military hero going into harm's way. But boy, you think about all your loved ones that are like, you know, dying, living and dying based on reports of what you're doing out there.
Yeah.
I thought it was really cool. I liked the whole, like, the little piece of part, like, bouncing against the hull as the magnetic, you know, apparently these fusion reactors are contained by a magnetic field they call a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing cycling was, I thought that was a really cool effect. It felt real.
Yeah.
I kind of agree that, like, I don't think Holden is being suicidal here. I think someone had to go check that thing out. And I don't know that he could have gotten away. I think he did the right thing.
Why can't you just put around through that thing like they do, first of all? I guess they wanted information. They weren't just looking to destroy it.
I guess that's true. He was looking, he didn't want to destroy it because I guess that's a good way.
Because they didn't really know,
like,
what they were up to, right? They just knew the implication.
He couldn't get the cover, but that's not, he didn't have like a binary getting the cover or, you know, securely unplugging the USB drive. There was a range of actions he could have took in between there that would have maybe destroyed the intelligence capabilities of it, but preserved him alive. But right. I was trying to think of like how much of this is the exhaustion? How much of this is the tension in the crew? How much of this is Holden risking his life yet again? How much of it is the fact of that he's risking his life in the context of Alex risking his life already for you know, dying for Naomi?
For Naomi, I mean, that's it. That's the
thing. And it's probably all of it, right?
Yeah, it is. It's all of it. And they've done a great job telling this story so far.
Yeah. And the herd just like, just come back inside. Like, it's like the crew is just really fractured. This next scene is indicative of this because Amos is going to use this opportunity, kind of a quiet downtime, to hash some things out with Naomi, especially in relation to their newest crewmate, Clarissa Mao, a.k.a. Melba, a.k.a. Peaches.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I just read book 5 and it kind of bothered me. It felt like Peaches was an affectation of Amos's. And it's one thing when he does that to like Murtry to piss him off, calls him Murphy and Murdy and Morty and stuff like that. But like the Peach, I don't know I find it distracting. Amos calling Clarissa Peaches. Am I alone on this island or?
When he first did it, it was distracting, but yeah, now I've gotten used to it. I call her Peaches in my notes at this point, so.
Yeah, me too. It's just weird. It's just weird, but nobody else is bothered by it, so whatever.
And she has like 15 names. Let's just, just pick one and go with it, and apparently Peaches is it.
Peaches ones. It's shorter than Clarissa, so there's that going for it.
I don't think Holden's ever going to call her Peaches. That would be the surprising thing.
I'm kind of curious to see how Holden relates to her because there wasn't any direct interaction and it seems like Naomi is let's get into this. Naomi's pissed that he forces her unilaterally onto the crew and Amos, you know, again, I just watched the series. This was a big thing in season 2 or 3. Naomi did a little thing called giving the protomolecule to Fred Johnson behind everyone's backs and almost broke up the crew once. Like they were all united against Naomi. They took her back in. I think Naomi doesn't have a leg to stand on.
Sure. And I think she knows that.
Does she?
Yeah. And if she were clear headed and thinking about the rest of her crew, the way she's thinking about Alex, she probably would have realized that instead of getting up in Amos's face. But I don't know. This 1-2 punch of like sitting in Alex's chair, 1-2-3 punch. It's a full combination, man. Sitting in Alex's chair, having Holden go off and do this stupid thing to try and save the world again. And then Amos, you know, doing this Peaches thing. These three things are just like digging at her in a state where she's already exhausted mentally and emotionally and physically. And so she just blows up at him. But I get it, right? I mean, she blames herself directly for the death of Alex. And I'm glad that they show that in the previously on.
Previously on package, yeah. It's a great package,
a lot more context
too.
To this scene.
Yeah, yeah. It really gives you everything you need to know to understand the season getting into it. So,
yeah.
Yeah, they do a really good job on the makeup because this crew does look like they had just been through the fucking ringer. Like, big circles on their eyes, drawn lines
especially
on their faces,
yeah.
Like, very little sleep, very little rest, relaxation, humor.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of dour ships, we go over to Drummers, and her first officer are debating where they can find refuge and resupply in this unfriendly belt and what they should do about their problematic crewmate, Michio. Is this late? This young woman's name? It seems like,
yeah,
Michio.
Yeah, Michio, which is
okay,
is weird. I talked about it a little bit in last season's podcast because she was still a character. She was a character last season. She's a character in the books, and Michio
macho
has
Peru
a lot
character
to do.
That you were always referring to.
Yeah, Michio Pa. And I guess they're turning Drummer into that, but
interesting because that they're just taking Macho Peru and putting her ass on shore. It seems like they are.
Yeah,
she is Miss also not appearing the rest of the season apparently. So I don't have to hear about Macho Peru any more fucking times. Hallelujah! It's just Drummer now. Great.
No, great. Unless something changes, I don't think we'll see much of her.
Interesting. Are you fine with that change?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we have much more of a connection to Drummer, and I don't need a specific name to do the things in Book 6. I just want the stuff in Book 6 to
interesting.
Happen.
Interesting.
So.
Because I will say that, like, it'd been my impression, again, spoiler-free, that this character that I kept on hearing the name of was something of a fan favorite.
Yeah, but I think you totally get there with Drummer. I don't think you need it to be a particular character. And Drummer has
Drummer
a lot
kinda
of
came out
what,
of nowhere.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
she
to become a fan favorite. So yeah, make her more of a fan favorite. Fuck it.
Yeah, absolutely. But I like
double
this.
Up the fan favorite.
Like, this is the fracturing of the other family in the belt here, right? And boy, families are getting just shit all over. Like, you got Philip and Marco. Marco's like treating Philip like he's 8 years old.
Vin Diesel standing in the corner, just a single tear rolling down his face. Uh-huh. All this family being torn in half. Not a corona in sight. What's
in zero
do?
G, the tears roll back and down his neck flap.
They collect in his neck folds
because there's so much gravity back there.
The gravity has so much mass. Yeah, of course, it's just science, people.
but I like seeing this, right? Like, the situations are tearing families apart.
And it's a great scene because, like, there's the hammer on this is, like, you know, them trying to be as sweet as possible. Like, hey, we're going to set you down someplace friendly. We're not going to forget about you. We're going to come back when all this is over. And she tearfully is like, when is this all going to be over?
Right.
And no one fucking knows.
In our lifetimes?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, what is it? Like, Earth recovering? That, like, might never happen. Like, it's just, I mean, it's one of those like sickening feelings that it's never going to go back to normal. There's a new normal and we're living in it. Yeah.
And I love there's a little detail at the end of the scene where Michio's crying in her bunk or whatever in a corner and Drummer makes a move to go over there and like comfort her. And whoever this other dude is, I don't know, her.
Yeah. The XO
ship, her husband /XO grabs her arm and stops her. And it's like, oh, you see Drummer's impulse is to protect her family, comfort her family, but in this case that's maybe not the right thing to do because you've got to make this hard decision and you're just going to make it harder if you keep if you keep letting it be a thing on the surface here. You got to let her understand what's happening and process it. Like,
that's part of being a leader, right? You make a decision that just sucks and there's no right words you can say to make this person okay with it. It's the right decision, but it's still going to hurt, you know?
Yeah.
And we've seen several of those times where Drummer's had to, like, you know, put things first, put things in a back burner, like learning, you know, the real command lessons. And this is an arc that she's been on ever since the Behemoth, you know,
for sure.
Her learning what it takes to be an effective, well-rounded commander, like becoming a person like Fred Johnson, and Anderson Dawes, being shaped by all these different forces, Klaus Ashford, and becoming her own kind of unique person. I do hope that, like, the story isn't that to be a good leader, you have to just sever and cauterize everything that makes you human, because I would like her to be a little bit more of a complete person than all those people I just mentioned. Like,
I don't think they're doing that, right? I mean, they're it's situational. It's situational. It's not a thing where you just need to cut off your emotions and you're a great leader. It's just, you need to know when to apply all of the, I don't know, levers of influence that you have. And I think she's learning those lessons.
Back on Ceres, Philip continues to crush on girls with his best friend, the gator-wearing gentleman we aforementioned, when he sees a cold, calculating, pragmatic side to his father that maybe he's not seen before, or at least directed towards his own people. What do you think of this scene?
Okay, so this is like both the scene where he's hanging out with friends and the one where Rosenfeld tells Marco that they don't owe these people on Ceres Station anything.
Yeah, it's like essentially, okay, how do we give the Ceres people more stuff? And she's like, we don't. Fuck them.
I really like what they're doing with Philip and Marco. They're showing how, man, Marco, what a piece of work this guy is. Even with his own son, the kid that he should be like training up to take the reins at some point, or at least like get him into these fights, you know, that his friend is bragging about, right? There's a weird like coddling that Marco is doing of Philip that is just making Philip resent him even more because he's not being brought into the loop here. And you can see it when he tries to say, well, you know, we need to, you just declared Ceres the capital of the belt. We have a responsibility to help these people. And they're like, oh yeah, how would you do that? We're open to your advice. Tell us exactly how you would do that. And he's like, don't know, because I'm 16. Hasn't been brought on any of these conversations. Like, but that's the thing. Like, he should be sitting down with Philip in all, and you know, it's not all Marco's fault either. Like, Marco invites him to meetings, right? And he shows up late because he's out fucking. So like,
but his dad also clearly is saying that these are, there's a very clear inference that Marco's in the background doing the internet. I'm doing it on a potty. It's a jerk off symbol about this, because like when he's right, like, did I miss anything? Is like the same as you usually do, which is not much. Oh, it's just talking about how we feed the people. Uh-huh. But that's the thing about these guys, is like, and it seems like it's possible to do this. Like, she's like, you know, we could take this time to boost our food production, do that. But they're literally plundering Ceres for, if you read between the lines here, they're pillaging Ceres for materials to beef up Medina Station.
Yeah.
And they're talking about it needs more titanium because the Laconian pieces are harder to install. They need to reinforce the abutments. I think they're upgrading that with Martian protomolecule technology to be like the real unstoppable warship that was intended to be. And that is just starving the belt, like that military project. And it's same thing happened to Earth and Mars. Instead of like emergency feeding their people, they're building war cruisers and battleships and stuff like that.
I get to say it's my first time of the season. Yeah. Get used to it. Hey, Ron, mildly interesting theory.
Yeah, it's and the thing is you see that the, you know, Philip is seeing this, that like, you know, Ceres isn't Medina. We need to tighten the food and water rations. We owe these people nothing. He's seen his father be ruthless to people who he thinks deserves it. But like you said, this is our capital city. We've told people to come here. We are the shining beacon. Oh, we can't feed them? Like, I think Philip's seeing that's fucked up.
Yeah, totally.
Also, that, like, yeah, it's a great that scene where his friends bragging about all the horrific shit they've done, and he kind of dissociates and has a borderline panic attack about, you know, this is Naomi's prophetic warning that you can't carry this weight, kid.
Yeah.
You know, death of billions on your hands.
Yeah, no, it's great. The other thing I wonder what they're doing with is there's a conspicuous coffee drinking scene here. His XO, whatever, Rosenfeld comes up and hands him a coffee and he drinks it and he's enjoying it. And I just couldn't help but think that Holden is the coffee guy. What are they doing with coffee as his drink of choice here? Is there anything?
Is this a dead man's brew thing again?
I mean, I'll always lean that way. Yeah, but I don't know. It was just strange to me because I don't know why they lingered on in a season where they have six episodes where the time is precious. Why are you doing this coffee thing if not to harken back to Holden drinking his coffee?
Is.
But
this
I don't
goes
know
back
what it
to
means.
Naomi's saying that, like, you know, Holden is the man that Marco says he is. Like, they're just, it's another kind of like similarity so that you can kind of see their. I even think they're dressed the same. Like, Phillip's jumpsuit, like his angel wings jumpsuit looks a lot like what Holden wears. It just, it's all gussied up and gilded. Like, there is like intentionally they're very similarly built. Like, it's just that every level where Jim Holden is the steak, Marco is just the sizzle. And I don't know, the coffee affectation might be another way to kind of draw those parallels.
Yeah.
Speaking of our resident caffeine addict, Holden is fretting about a video that seems to show a ring gate eating a Martian warship. I believe this is what we saw at the end of last season.
Yep.
While Naomi has uncovered a possible weakness in Marco's asteroid blockade.
Yeah, she's pinpointed a ship probably called the Azure Dragon that they think is the one controlling the launch of these rockets, these rocks, rather.
It's a spotter ship. So apparently it is orbiting dark and it's able to keep a precise track of the disposition of Earth's defense. And it's able to, anytime Earth tries to get a little breathing room to go, you know, interdict, they keep a steady stream of rocks to keep that from happening. Apparently without those spotter ships, it'd be a hell of a lot less effective. At least that's the theory.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that Amos starts this scene with Holden telling him, like, hey, let's stay on mission here. We are here to kill Marco. That is what we are out here to do. And then when Naomi diverts the mission with this information, he's just like, okay, let's go. Is that because he knows that, you know, 2/3 of the voting crew at this point is aligned against him? Or on board with this mission, or is that because he views this mission as part of the Get Marco mission?
I think the latter. Amos is a lot more strategic and tactical than people like. I mean, they really make this explicit in the books, and I think really underlined it last season. But Amos could have took over
face first into a lot of shit.
True, but Amos probably could have led Eric's Baltimore underworld and lunar crew better than Eric could have.
Those are
muscles that Amos hasn't actually tried to flex much. But I think he is capable of doing it. So I think he's a better leader, and he's got a better eye for, like, you know, that kind of like logistics and like if you go over this guy, you blind your enemy, it's going to be a lot easier. Ooh, that's interesting because, you know, season four, Amos found out all about what it's like to be blinded and how vulnerable it makes you. But if you blind your enemy, it's easier to take him down. I think he gets that.
For sure. Okay.
And we also get the scene of, you know, Naomi, you know, because Holden says, hey, I fucked up on the rock. I'm going to be more careful. And she's like, we're not stopping. Mm-hmm. And the problem is this whole situation, this Belter Civil War, where I'm attacking people and places I used to call home and used to call friends. It's really wearing, and I don't know how much I can take. But she does. She does look like she's at the breaking point with this.
Mm-hmm.
On board her flagship, the UNN Zenobia, Ava Sarala shoots down rumors she's seeking a peace treaty with Marco and Neros and the Free Navy. I like this scene.
Yeah, I don't get the impression that they have done any negotiation. I think that's what Monica's getting at. Like, you need to negotiate because things are so fucking bad. We can't just stay pinned down here. You clearly don't have the military might to change the situation. So let's start talking. Let's open lines of communication. That's where she's getting at. But, like, I don't know, man. I think that's insane. I think it would be
insane
to try and talk Marco into some kind of deal. He's not a guy who makes deals.
That's a tough thing about real life, is because you got warhawks and you got doves, man. And sometimes the warhawks are saying there is no chance for peace when there's abundant. You're tripping over chances of peace.
That's what Aaron Wright was sometimes all about, doves, right? That guy was, I mean, granted, he had ulterior motives, but also
But his ulterior motive was Earth first, like at the very root of it. And the other thing is, like, and sometimes the doves, like, you know, like people wanted to appease Hitler. There's like, because like war sucks. And it's damaging, and nothing good comes from it. But sometimes that's literally the last resort.
And it's like the Souther part of it, right? It's the guy who just wants to, like, no, maybe we should cool it. Right. Maybe we should not do anything here until we know what to do. Yeah.
And what's great about The Expanse is all those. I feel like all those factions throughout the six seasons have all had their time to be right, all had their time to be wrong.
Yeah.
And that's why history is the fucking devil, man.
And Christian is kind of in the middle, right? She's both when she needs to be.
And the fact that she's being imperious and secretive, like, that's the thing, is like, that feels like that she's holed up for these last 6 months with her war advisors, and, you know, she's running a tight ship, which is probably the way you should prosecute a war. But clearly, you know, if you're a person worrying about starving on Earth, you would like to know, like, what the hell is actually happening? Are we in a democracy or not?
Mm-hmm.
And then I like Bobby bouncing, you know, Monica, and Monica scoring some hits, because, you know, Bobby's never been 100% on board with Madame Avasarala. And,
feels like she's getting used half the time, but isn't really sure how.
Yep. Yep. I looked up the UNN Zenobia. So this is named Zenobia, was a 3rd century queen and empress of an offshoot empire. So the 3rd century was bad for Rome, and they had a series of assassinations and imperial fails that had like 2/3 of the empire broke off, and Zenobia ran off with the eastern portion that included much of what do they call that? Middle Asia, the like Greece and Syria and things like that, down into Egypt. I looked up her in Wikipedia. That said that Zenobia is a cultured monarch and fostered an intellectual environment in her court, which is open to scholars and philosophers. She was tolerant towards her subjects and protected religious minorities. The queen maintained a stable administration, which governed a multicultural, multi-ethnic empire. Her rise and fall have inspired historians, artists, and novelists, and to this day, she's a patriotic symbol in Syria. I thought that's a really great... This warrior queen, warrior philosopher queen, is a great name for the flagship of Avasarala.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I like it.
And she doesn't sound like she spends much time on Earth, as, you know, she probably should not. She's spending most of her time on a big badass warship in orbit.
Mm-hmm.
On Sirius Station, Philip tries to pick up the one girl in the belt apparently uninterested in what he has to offer, and it does not go well.
Yeah, no, he turns on his friend here and ends up shooting him. He does a similar thing in the book. It's not his friend. It's just some other dude. But, like, yeah, they're getting back to where the book was with Philip at this point, which is exciting, knowing what comes after.
All the things that Naomi feared for her son are coming to pass. Like, he just manifestly is unable to deal with the hero worship and the adoration he's getting for doing things that he knows in his gut are wrong. And also seeing how there's the punch, the sequence of events happening here. Then on top of that, seeing kind of what a hypocrite his father is. That, like, oh, sure, we're going to do terrible things, but the terrible people to uplift our people. And no, it's still just to serve for the grandiosity of his father. And
I might have done all that for a lie, for a fiction, right? Like this beautiful vision that my father was painting isn't actually a vision at all. He doesn't give a shit about the vision. All he gives a shit about is his own glory. Yeah, it's a potent stew that they're bringing up here. And
I was going to ask you what you thought Philip felt in the moment he shot his friend.
Regret, I think, for sure. Like, I don't know, the stuff going on with Philip is so complex, because, like, yes, he realizes, I think, deep down underneath it all, that what he did was wrong. He's starting to see the reasons he did it, the people he did it for, are just full of shit and they're not the people he thought they were. And that even the part that should be the reward, the part where he's the hero of the belt alongside of his father, is not getting him what he wants either. Like, sure, he can have, you know, 15 different girls over in the cargo hold, but, you know, he can't just walk up to anyone and wave this hero card in their face and get exactly what he wants.
Love from everyone. Yeah.
Right.
One
so like
holdout.
Nothing is quite turning out the way he wanted it to or thought, imagined that it would in his head before he actually launched these rocks. But when he agreed to do all this stuff with his father. So I think, man, what's going on in his head is just, it's a mess right now, which is why his friend dies in the first place.
And it's such a great contrast between these two teenage boys doing teenage boy stuff, running around, cruising for girls, looking dapper to impress them, spitting game, with the contrast of also they have the blood of millions on their hands.
Oh, yeah. He ceased to child be soldiers, just a teenage boy as soon as those rocks launched.
Back on the Zenobia, Avasarala cooks up a daring operation that's going to involve Naomi's spottership theory and Bobby being a badass. And you know what, Jim? I'm just excited to be here to see it. I have no idea exactly why Bobby's going to be the linchpin for this mission, but fuck it. She's going to be a structural support at some point between two ships. They're going to turn her suit into a missile that kills Marco. Something's going to be badass. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Did this happen in the books? That's what I wanted to know. Does she formally join the crew of the Rock? Really? Really? Holy fuck.
Not that I remember. Just totally blanked out the word Bobby in my head, but no.
I thought this was
nearly the part in the books that she is in the show.
You're right. She's like she's a big part of five, so I just assumed that they were priming her to be, you know, a part of the crew in the book six. I'm shocked to find out that's not true.
Is she a big part of five? It's been a while since
all that stuff with her, like Alex visiting Mars and them hooking up and figuring out where all the ships are going and them fleeing. I mean, they're even a bigger part, right, because they've got like the Martian prime minister in the book along for the ride. But this is a great scene. It's also got Avasarala on the float. You know, we first met her hating space, not ever leaving Earth if she can't help it. And now she's actually enjoying not having the planet pulling her down.
Yeah. I love how poetic what she's saying here is. She's had all this responsibility. We met her day one and she's like trying to keep the children from destroying their toys. Right. Since day one, and now here she is in the worst possible situation, and everything is on her because all the children are dead. It's you feel the weight of it. You feel the weight through everything they've done in this first episode. It's weighing on everyone, not just Christian, but she is she's the tip of the spear when it comes to fixing this problem. And it's got to be heavy.
Yeah, 100%. And it's a great, like, as she's saying, like, we need something better than good. We need a huge wind that's going to pull all of us together and give us the most important quantity in something like this, hope. And it's such a great backdrop to the crew, the Rocinante, like, strapping in and getting into the crash couches and, like, you know, like unknowingly preparing. I am a little worried because this is Avasarala, like, big, splashy show. You know, like not small wins, not a string of pearls that you build to an elegant, but just like a swing for the fucking fences. Sometimes I suspect her political instincts. I don't think that they're good. She's a good leader. She's not a good politician.
I will say this. I think if you're imagining that taking out the Azure Dragon is the only thing she has plans for, you're going to be surprised, I think.
It's also interesting that, like, Zenobia was a queen of ruling over one third of an empire. And if you take the Earth, the Mars, and the Belt,
yeah,
that's interesting because she doesn't remain the ruler. You know, obviously, Rome is able to get back. I wonder if there is, like, some hopefulness in this imagery that, you know, she will. All the factions will be able to come back together into a truly human empire, which I guess it wouldn't even be an empire at that point.
Yeah.
It would just be a loose human confederation mm-hmm. of like chill dudes doing things in the cosmos.
It'd be Star Trek. And
joint yeah. cooperation. Yeah. Yeah. It'd be the United Federation of Planet. Uh-huh. No, we already got planets. Fuck it. Yeah.
Yeah, UFP. We have
Star
two.
Trek, baby.
That's an S.
Yeah, S-worthy. Got two planets and planetoids. You've got now various planets, but they're all cut off. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the first episode of The Expanse. I can't wait to see the second one. If you feel the same, drop us a line. Expanse@baldmove.com is how you get a hold of us. Of course, we'll have full coverage of the episode as soon as it drops each Thursday evening, early Friday morning, depending on when Amazon drops it. Because we are recording these in advance to get things ready, we are not going to be doing feedback for the first two podcast. We will do a special feedback episode after those two podcasts to kind of catch up. Then we'll do three and four through the Christmas break. We'll do another feedback episode after in the new year to catch us up, and then we'll be doing five and six in real time with y'all. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite pleased to have you all on the ride with us. And again, expanse@baldmove.com if you want to give us your latest theories or your thoughts on, I don't know, Anderson Dawes dying off screen, Avasarala's desperate gambit here, whatever. expanse@baldmove.com. We'll see you back next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.